I'm Kara Lawrence. Andrew Kohler, the conductor of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra, is joining me this morning to preview Sunday's concert, which comes at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium and is called Spirit of the Dance. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you back. I know it's going to be a whirlwind season, spring season for you, with a lot of activity. But let's focus on the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra.
Let's, yeah.
This is a special concert that features the winner of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra concerto competition.
Right, exactly. So the spring concert is always a good time to celebrate a sort of rite of passage in the life of youth orchestras, which of course is honoring our graduating seniors. So we always take the spring concert as an opportunity to kind of look inwardly and really, I mean, every one of our concerts is a celebration of our students, I think, but especially we try and make it so on the spring concert. So of course we acknowledge all the seniors who are graduating, going on to universally higher education. And we have this concerto competition that we run each year, which is judged by an outside panel. And we're really excited because there's something very unusual that happened this year with the winner. And it goes a long way towards underlining the multifaceted talents that we have hidden within the orchestra. Alex Smith, who is a really very excellent cellist, and in fact serves as our principal cellist in the orchestra, won the concerto competition this year, but he won it not as a cellist, but rather as a vocal soloist. He has a whole other life as this great singer. He's frequently on stage at the Civic Theater, and I know that he also, I believe, sings with the Grand Chorus, or one of the choruses at Western under Dr. Kim Dunn Adams's direction. So he's really a very fine young singer, in addition to being such a great cellist. And it's just a real treat for us to get to welcome a winner of the internal concerto competition who's going to be singing with us.
What will he be singing?
Well, what he won the concerto competition with is this wonderful aria by Mozart that I think we'll take a listen to in just a second, called Non più andrai, from The Marriage of Figaro. I've also additionally asked him, because that's a relatively short piece, just a few minutes in length, to sing another aria by Handel called Si tra i ceppi. And it's nice, you know, because our whole overall program this spring is about, really about the dance. But seen another way, what underlines the program is the idea that John Adams, the contemporary American composer, has a lovely quote where he says, "Music must not lose its track of its roots in the vernacular." And I think that's a really beautiful idea, you know, that no matter how sophisticated, no matter how complicated music can get, that at some level, singing is always just a song, you know, and at some level, playing is always derived from dance. That's really the division. That's the fundamental cultural division that we have in music, right? That instrumental music derives from dance, and that anything that's vocal is a kind of song, you know? And yes, these operatic arias are certainly far more difficult and virtuosic than a mother singing a lullaby to her baby, but they're somehow joined. They're somehow still fundamentally a similar gesture. Anyway, so a lot of our program, the instrumental portion, of course, is dedicated to music that has a particularly close relationship to the dance. And then in Alex's case, he's singing two arias from the 18th century, one from earlier in the 18th century, the Handel I was just mentioning, and then later, the Mozart in the 18th century. And both were writing at a time when it was becoming increasingly fashionable, actually, to write in a simpler style, in one that was more natural, more immediately recognizable for audiences, the song. So it kind of fits quite nicely into the program. But the Handel that he'll sing, that he'll open the concert with, is from an opera seria, a serious opera, and it involves sort of, well, as I put it, fundamentally, there's a love triangle. Berenice, the queen of Egypt, loves this prince, but the prince really loves Berenice's sister. Actually, it's something more like a love pentagon or more. I don't know. It gets really complicated in some of these late Baroque operas. But in the end, this love of hers named Demetrio is overheard declaring his love for her sister. She's incensed. Berenice is, of course. So she throws him in jail. And while in jail, he sings of the fidelity of his love for her sister, Selene. So that's the first aria that he sings. But a little bit more fun, I think, is the Mozart aria that we'll take a listen to. The Marriage of Figaro is also, in a much more lighthearted way, about all these amorous intrigues. And, of course, as the title implies, the main characters, Figaro, and or I guess his wife as well, Susanna, are looking to get married.
Yeah.
But they're being thwarted at every turn by various factors. Susanna is also being chased by various men that she's not interested in. One is their boss. They're both servants. So the count who employs them, he's got a rather lecherous disposition. And so he's got an eye on Susanna, and he's the real threat here. But then there's also this young teenage boy named Cherubino. And Cherubino is just sort of in the throes of young passion. He's just sort of falling in love with anything female in front of him. He can't help himself. He's obviously not too serious a threat. But just to be sure, when the count finds out that Cherubino is also chasing Susanna and sees him as a kind of threat, he says, well, that's it. Off to the army with you. He sends him off to the army. And Figaro has a laugh at poor Cherubino's expense, singing things like, oh, you amorous butterfly, no more fluttering about chasing after women inside. Now you're going to be in the army. You're going to be marching over mountain and through the valleys, through snowfall, through heat stroke, you know, with bullets whizzing past your ears. And then he sort of goads him on to military victory. It's all very tongue-in-cheek. And Mozart, of course, brilliantly sets this to effectively a military march, which is not the most natural marriage to an aria. But
no.
It's clear what the intention here is. So I think if we take a listen now, your listeners will easily hear these sort of military gestures in the music and the rather lighthearted tone that Figaro is roasting poor Cherubino with.
Non comprai farfallone amoroso, notte giorno d'intorno girando, nelle belle tue valle il riposo, narcisetto aroncino d'amor. Nelle belle tue valle il riposo, narcisetto aroncino d'amor. Alla gloria di quest'or, alla gloria
from The Marriage of Figaro, one of the highlights performed by Figaro in the opera. My guest is Andrew Kohler, who will conduct the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony on Sunday at 4 o'clock. And, of course, why are we playing vocal music? Because the competition winner is a vocalist, Alex Smith.
Mm-hmm. In addition to being a cellist. I mean, he, and not just a cellist, but our principal cellist, a very fine cellist.
What age is he, or what?
He's a junior this year, so luckily we have him for one more year before he goes off somewhere else.
Any idea where he's getting his vocal training from?
Yes, he's studying with Ken Pruitt, who is a faculty member here at Western Michigan University.
And sometimes college faculty accept younger students.
Correct. In fact, his cello teacher is also Bruce Uchimura, so he's really very well rooted here at Western.
And his parents themselves are terrific musicians.
Both terrific musicians and also faculty members at Western. So all in the family right here.
Right, right. Well, I'm glad Alex could, gain from that, but also pursue not one, but two musical passions.
Yeah. And at such a high level. I think that's really quite rare, you know, because many of our students are might play a second instrument or something like that. But usually by this point, they've really started winnowing down to one or the other as their main instrument. And I think Alex is still really pulled in both directions. Certainly we hope he keeps playing cello in the orchestra. But he really is a very gifted singer, and he really displays incredible prowess in both fields.
You know, he's singing in different languages.
Yes.
Has he translated the meanings of the poetry so that he can sing in, from a place of understanding the intent?
I am certain that he has, because I'm sure that Mr. Pruitt has made sure of it. Yes, so in fact, I allowed him, when we first started rehearsing with the orchestra, to explain what was going on in these arias. And he did so very, very, I didn't tell him I was going to ask him to do that, and he did so very readily. So he obviously had a very good sense of what he was singing already.
The concert is Sunday at 4 o'clock, and it's called Spirit of the Dance. And let's get back to this idea that if you break it all down and simplify everything very, like, to its core, instrumental music has its roots in dance music, and vocal music has its roots in songs.
In song. Yeah, exactly right. And I think, you know, if you look at the history of instrumental music as it developed, that makes it even more clear, because so much instrumental music in the late Renaissance and into the Baroque was very much just openly dance suites. Even by the time of Bach, when we're getting to the early 18th century, he was also still writing dance suites. By that time, those dances had tended to be somewhat memorialized already. He was already writing on older dance forms, ones that weren't necessarily danced very actively anymore. But nonetheless, they still preserve that sense, right? You think even the solo partitas for violin, or the suites for cello, or the orchestral suites, many of them are dance-derived. They're all coming from the dance. And that's preserved through the evolution of the symphony in the late classical era, because at least one movement, right, always bears this title, usually a minuet, and then it became a scherzo, which is sort of a sped-up version of it. But these are all fundamentally, you know, dance, openly dance-derived movements. And then that's only on the surface, because obviously even those other movements that don't necessarily bear a literal dance title might still have some of that energy, dance-like energy, that informs the way that they were written. Now, of course, it gets more and more complicated as we go on through the ages. There are times when, you know, you think of something like a Mahler symphony, and yes, at some level, you can still hear him writing scherzos or minuets, or even for him, a Lendler, right, exactly, that sort of even more peasant-like Austrian dance. But nonetheless, in such complicated textures that were pretty far removed from anybody actually dancing those things. Even though he was doing that just a generation after, say, the waltz craze had gripped all of Europe, and certainly Vienna most particularly. Anyway, all this is to say, we're now going to play some music on our concert this Sunday from the late 19th century and the early 20th century. And in each case, this is music that, as complicated, sophisticated as it is, openly celebrates its relationship with dance, kind of wears it on its heart on its sleeve, as it were, and just allows that wonderful sense of pulse to be ever more immediate. And the first of those is the Grieg Symphonic Dances. And it's an interesting title, Symphonic Dances. He has tried to bridge the gap between a full symphony, which, as we were discussing, is derived from but fairly far removed from the dance, and more direct dance form. So how could he get kind of a symphonic scope and sensibility and development, but with fundamentally dance forms? Well, one of the ways he does that is that each movement kind of follows the same basic pattern. We have one initial idea, a contrasting idea in the middle, and then a repetition of that first idea. That's a sort of classic formula for dance.
ABA.
ABA, exactly right. So he does that in each one of his movements. But at the same time, he superimposes each dance with the general feelings that one, by precedent, tends to have in a symphony. So the first movement, the A material, is moderately upbeat and fast. In the second movement, it's very lyrical. The third one is the most obviously dance-like, and is in a three-meter pattern, or three-beat pattern within the meter. And then the last one is perhaps the most thrilling, exciting, and complicated of the set. So one really does feel the scope of a symphony, even though each individual movement has such wonderful folk-derived music. That's the other important thing to mention about Grieg, is that he was, of course, a deeply nationalistic composer. He was renowned throughout Europe, a great pianist, a great teacher, pedagogue, performer, all these things. But he was a great champion of his native Norway.
I agree with all of those things, but he was also notably unable to compete in the giant form arena. There's one symphony from his younger days.
From his younger days, which he largely disowned and felt was not his most successful, correct?
Mm-hmm. So many of his most famous pieces, which I would say are the lyric pieces mm-hmm. for piano, now they're based on dances.
Yep.
I don't think the symphonic dances for orchestra are played that often.
They are not played that often, and I think unjustly so, because they are really wonderful works. And I think this is the way that he cracked that nut, so to speak.
Yeah.
He also has a piano concerto, of course. That's a very famous piano concerto that's very successful on the large scale.
Yeah.
But you're right. Mostly Grieg was principally renowned as a miniaturist. That's where he felt most at home. And I think by using these dance forms, by hewing so closely to dance forms and using actual Norwegian folk music in his setting, he was able to kind of come up with a work that is about a half hour in length, so just about symphonic proportions, but that still fundamentally retains the simplicity, the feeling of dance music.
Now, decade or two earlier, Dvorak and an earlier Brahms had created suites of dances.
Right.
Do these advance from there, or are they really, is he basically creating a Norwegian version of the Slavonic dances?
I think only in the sense that he's tried to organize them in this symphonic fashion. And I should add that one other thing is that sometimes that secondary contrasting material within one of the dances derives from the first theme. So he does manage to make it something like a development. So that's another way in which he hints at a sort of some of the things that drive what Western music thinks of as symphonic in nature. There is a level of sophistication there. I think for the listener, fundamentally, the takeaway is the same as in Dvorak's Slavonic dances or Brahms' Hungarian dances. That is a passionate, immediate, very melody-driven relationship and a great sense for the listener of connecting with a folk spirit.
Anything else we should listen for in the first dance?
I don't think so.
Okay, let's hear a recording of Grieg's symphonic dance, the first piece mm-hmm. out of four.
Four, exactly right.
In the suite. And again, the concert on Sunday starts at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium. Details at kjso.org. Music of Edvard Grieg, and I'm with Andrew Kohler, the conductor of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra, who will lead the young group in the Spirit of the Dance, which is the program Sunday at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium, as always. It's the final concert of the season.
It is our final concert of the season, and we'll be having auditions coming up in May for next year's group, so we hope that we will have lots of people coming out that can fill in those spaces from another very talented and very significantly sized senior class that will be leaving us.
Oh, once again, yeah, it's hard to let them go.
It is always hard to let them go, yes. I keep trying to encourage them to fail their classes, but they're all such overachievers, and I keep insisting.
do they tell you some of their plans, or college and
oh, yeah,
like that?
Absolutely, yeah. I try and be in touch with many of them about their plans. One in particular is having an incredibly difficult time deciding between Northwestern and the University of Michigan. Another one was deciding between University of Michigan and Oberlin. And Still a third is also going to the University of Michigan. I mean, that's obviously a big draw given where we are located. But yeah, we've got people going all kinds of great places. We have recent alums at Johns Hopkins and at Brown University, and really they're a very awfully accomplished group of students, certainly.
And what can get accomplished? I imagine going to rehearsal, is it once a week?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And in between, you know, you've had 6 days of other things taking over your life.
Mm-hmm.
But there must be some very special rehearsals that where once in a while you really feel like the whole group has moved a significant way by the end of that small period of hours.
Yeah. Yes, that. And I would say maybe even more compellingly is some little thing that lets you take stock of how far the ball has moved over a bigger period of time. Something like, for example, I remember in my first years in the orchestra, the concerto competition winner did the Tchaikovsky concerto, and we did the first movement of it. And then a few years later, I think we did that same piece again because the Stolberg winner wanted to do it. And I remember how much smoother that rehearsal process was the second time around, even though there were many new players. And it really felt to me evidence that a culture had been built up where sort of the amount of preparation expected was higher, and people were taking that seriously, and we were able to really accomplish that much more with our music making. So in both senses, yeah, those are absolutely some of the most rewarding moments with working with a youth orchestra. There are plenty of hair-tearing frustrations, but when it's at its most beautiful, you see these students who are still so malleable, right? Their abilities are still shaping, their talents are still being formed. Take something on and invest in it and absolutely transform.
You know what's kind of weird is if you're any other kind of musician, you practice and you pretty much get to play the melody. But if you're in an orchestra, you're working on parts that don't necessarily make sense without hearing the melody. Mm-hmm. It can seem like, what is this on the page?
Yeah, that's a real challenge. That's a real challenge in our particular subsection of this art. There's no question about it. Certainly, that's why, you know, certain kinds of violinists say they want to always be first violinists because they want that tune more often. But yeah, sometimes playing those inner voices can be a mark of great musicianship and forces you to be able to spur on a greater sense of imagination and to be able to internalize music better, because you need to listen to it, you need to know what the melody is and know how you can support it and be able to imagine it while you're playing it. So I do encourage, of course, listening to recordings. I encourage even practicing along with recordings, which I think is a really important step for our students. And I hope that they do it.
If you play along to someone else's recording and then the director doesn't use the same tempos or the same feel, it can be
jarring. Of course, there are going to be changes. But I think ultimately the benefit of being able to hear all those things and play alongside mm-hmm. makes you a flexible musician, makes you the smaller part of it will be able to say, oh, well, now Kohler is going to take that faster or slower or something like that, and we'll have to readjust there. If they're able to do the first part, the second should come fairly easily.
Well, would you take us back into the Symphonic Dances of Grieg again? Because it'd be neat to hear a second piece.
Yeah. Well, maybe just as an illustration, I suppose, of...
Oh, forgive me. I just realized we need to talk about Delius instead of Grieg.
Okay, let's talk about Delius then.
I know you can change on a dime.
Very happily so. Actually, Delius is perhaps the composer that needs... I mean, I think a lot of your listeners are already familiar with Grieg. So Delius is a very interesting character.
Yep.
He is
a weirdo.
Yeah, he is a bit of a weirdo. I think that's a good way to put it. And he tends, during his lifetime and now, to elicit very strong opinions about his music. So I was recently at a meeting of music lovers and describing this concert to one of them and said that we were doing a piece by Delius. And one person, totally unprompted, said, "Oh, I hate Delius." And I actually have at least one cellist in the orchestra who at the very beginning of the concert cycle said, "I don't like this piece." And then just the other week, I looked over at her and said, "How about now?" And she said, "Nope." So I guess it's not, it won't win over every heart and mind. But hold on, before your listeners go running out of the room here, I love it. I think this piece is so fascinating and is an utterly unique voice. So for a select group of people, I think Delius is really sort of held up as a really great and underappreciated composer. And I think he has incredible whimsy, incredible imagination, and such incredible color in his orchestrating. So I really was taken with his first dance rhapsody, and I hope your listeners will be compelled to come to the concert and give this a chance. And if not, fear not, it's sandwiched between Grieg and Defia, and everybody loves those.
I know Frederick Delius is one of the kind of group of early 20th century British composers who can sometimes be identified with the English pastoral sound or English impressionists in a way.
That's very true. Certainly orchestrationally he sounds that way, but he's not necessarily as... He does have certainly some works that... Briggs Fair and things like that do kind of tap into that folk idiom. But he was also, he got out of England a lot. He spent time
traveled.
In Florida.
Yeah.
And he was influenced deeply by a plantation song that he heard there. He studied actually with Grieg, who was his mentor of a sort in Leipzig. So he spent time in Germany, spent time in France, and eventually came back to England. But he was really very well traveled and had a lot of different disparate influences.
Right.
Certainly in this dance rhapsody, one hears a very folk-like tune. And I think one of the things that's so incredible about his treatment of it, well, there are a couple things. One is that he uses a massive and richly colored orchestra for this one relatively short 12-minute piece, including, and I'm very proud to say that thanks to one of our players and the family of one of our players, we have this instrument, a bass oboe.
What?
Exactly. What? Who's ever heard of such a thing? But there is a bass oboe in this, and it has a wonderful, lugubrious kind of solo at the beginning of this piece that I think we'll hear shortly. So Allison Lee is one of the members of the orchestra, and her family very graciously, in partnership with the KJSO, decided we'll splurge to rent this instrument so that we could do it as Delius intended. And it really is a very distinctive color in the orchestra. It's a wonderful addition. So there's that. There's that wonderful color. And then the way he uses that to great effect is that the very opening is as I just described it, very lugubrious, very dark. But right after that finishes, it's sort of wiped away, and then we hear the tune in the regular oboe, and that's you'll hear that the main tune in its sort of natural form is very cheeky, very impish, almost having quite a bit of fun. And really, except for a middle section, so there is again a little ABA going on here that's a bit different. Mostly, it's just that tune being repeated in various voices, but he subtly alters the harmony. He's always chromatic. There's this almost kaleidoscope of subtle chromatic changes to the harmony, sometimes very densely written. And there's this wonderful push-pull of rhythm where sometimes he's speeding up the theme and sometimes he slows it down a lot at the end and sometimes he slows it down only a little and sometimes he doesn't slow it down at all. And all these things manage to create this atmosphere that sounds like one continuously improvised version of this tune. So I really, strong feelings notwithstanding that he tends to elicit in his listeners, I really think this is a wonderful work and one well worth giving a chance to.
I mentioned early 20th century. Any idea closer to the date of...
This was about 1905. So this is really in those very first years of the 20th century that it was completed.
Well, let's hear music from the Dance Rhapsody of Frederick Delius.
Thank you.
That's a delightful little tune.
Isn't it? I'm so glad you agree. See, we've got at least two people who are big fans of Delius.
Yes,
here.
Pro-Delius contingent can arrive at 4 o'clock for the concert on Sunday in Chenery Auditorium for the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra concert, the final concert of the season. The symphony, of course, can use your support and use seats in the people in the seats to enjoy music made by talented young people from West Michigan.
Yeah.
The Delius is the fourth piece, or rather the fourth feature, let's say.
Right. On the program. It'll start our second half, yes.
Well, we have, about 9 minutes left in the hour, and finally the Defia should get some attention.
It should. This is another incredible work from the early 20th century, and here the relationship to dance, of course, is most overt. Not only is it derived from actual Spanish dances, and he, like Grieg before him, was very much influenced by folk music, in this case that of his native Spain, but it was written as a ballet, so it was written to be danced, in fact. So on both counts, this is very, very much dance music, and it is really thrilling. One of the most wonderfully successful ballets of the early 20th century, I would argue. And the creation of it was a fantastic who's who of major names. Serge Diaghilev, the great impresario, the great Russian impresario who was living in France at the time, commissioned him to expand an existing work for the Ballet Russe. And Leonid Massine choreographed it. Pablo Picasso did the set design for this production. So it was really, really quite a starry constellation of great artists coming together.
Manuel Defia, was he still a young composer and unknown at that time?
He was youngish at that time, as was Diaghilev's preference for working with sort of emerging composers. But he had already finished conservatory. That's where he had first started to think about composing with these sort of Spanish folk styles. And then his resolve was strengthened by hearing the success of figures like Debussy and Ravel, whom he met in Paris, and seeing that they also were fascinated by Spanish folk music mm-hmm. and had great successes in some of their works by channeling it. And he thought, well, if they can do it, I mean, surely I'm even more qualified to do it. This is, in the end, my music. This story is, the ballet's story, is a rather humorous one, sort of another mistaken identity farce. And it's really about a governor who wears a three-cornered hat. That's a symbol of his wealth. That's why the title is the three-cornered hat. And he comes and fancies, this is not unlike the Marriage of Figaro, this miller's wife. The miller chases him off, but then in retaliation, the governor has the miller arrested. And then the governor comes back and tries again, but is thwarted by the wife, and then manages to slip somehow into a river, and so has to take off his clothes and changes into the clothes of the miller. The miller breaks out of jail, sees the clothes lying around, and obviously, since the clothes make the man, I suppose, poses as the governor, has the governor in the miller's clothes rearrested, so he's dragged off, and then all live happily ever after, and everything's sort of forgiven. And I'm not quite sure if we'll be able to get that far, but as we listen to this last movement, which is full of exciting, propulsive rhythms, a lot of two against three combinations, and at the very end, there are these wonderful swoops of color, right, with where the orchestra comes way down and then makes a huge crescendo. Yeah. Like Delius, like Debussy, like Ravel, Defia was a great orchestrator and really knew his craft and creates such wonderful colors in the orchestra. And those swoops are supposed to be the assembled ballet corps throwing the governor up in the air in a blanket.
Any complaints from the orchestra on this one?
No, I think this one is a success for one and all.
Well, I hope you enjoy conducting the concert on Sunday, and I hope folks listening will come out and enjoy it as well. It's at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium. The Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra website is kjso.org. Any hints about the next season?
We have our date set and a couple of plans, still not ready to be revealed publicly, but I am working on them.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining me again.
My pleasure. Thank you. ¶¶